you like this episode, please subscribe, share with others, rate and review so we can continue to bring you great programming.
This is The Thing About Cars, a podcast for car enthusiasts and the people who love them.
Hello, we are back with another episode of The Thing About Cars. I'm one of your hosts, Mickey Desai. Around the table, we have our usual crew. I see Ben.
Hey.
And Dawn.
Hello, everyone.
And Misty.
Hiya.
And the man, the myth, the living parade, Dave.
Press any key to continue.
And our good friend, Spencer. Spencer's in Tennessee, right, Spencer?
That's correct.
What part of Tennessee?
I'm in Nashville, nice, happy seat of it.
Yes, got it. So we're going to talk about all things ambulances today, I hope. But before we get into that, let's have a moment of Grand Trivia Auto. Before we do Grand Trivia Auto, I've got a small moment of Grand Dawn Auto. You ready, Dawn?
Yeah.
Dawn looks like her airbag just went off.
This question is specifically for Dawn. Misty, what's this product called?
Serena Soul.
You got that?
Yeah.
Is this product something like a spice mix you sprinkle on top of butter on toast? Is it, what's it called again, Misty?
Serena Soul.
Is that a traditional Bulgarian dress? Is it a crankcase additive to increase your oil viscosity? Or is it a tanning lotion used in self-tanning booths and self-tanning salons?
Possibly E, all of the above.
It's a tanning lotion.
It's a tanning lotion. Spencer, you want to take a guess?
I was going to say something you add to increase the viscosity, but I have no idea. I'm just saying that because it's a car podcast, so I just assume.
that's a reasonable piece of logic right there. But unfortunately, this has everything to do with the nonsense and frivolity that we had before we started recording. What's this thing called, Misty?
Serena Soul.
Serena Soul is a spice mix you sprinkle on butter.
Okay. Serena Soul. Okay. I was thinking soul is actually sun in various languages. So yeah, that's what got me thinking it was a tanning solution. But
that's what I thought too. That's why I came up with that possibility. But yeah, we were just having fun with various not pieces of nonsense before we hit recording.
Gotcha.
So our real Grand Trivia Auto question for today is from our trivia czar, Tim. The Pontiac Fiero mid-engine sports car was sold from 1984 to 1988. What does Fiero mean? Does it mean cruel, proud, wild, fire, or all of the above? So we'll answer that question at the end of the show.
I wanted one of those so bad.
Oh, same.
I almost turned one over once. As low of a center of gravity they had, I almost turned one over at 30 miles an hour.
Oh my gosh. I was in college during those 4 years and I wanted one of those. And all the little frat boys had one that couldn't afford a Porsche.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
They were cool little cars.
They were cool little cars. They were fun. I got to ride a few.
Gorgeous.
Well, I've got another one from Tim, since that one seems like a straightforward answer. The second Grand Trivia piece of Grand Trivia Auto for today is, what is GM's rope drive, which was introduced in the 1961 Pontiac Tempest? Rope drive. Is rope drive the steering, choice A, the steering wheel was made of thick cotton rope covered in rigid bakelite resin designed to collapse during a significant collision. B, a smaller, lighter starter motor tightened by a spool of cable rather than spun gear to turn over the engine. It was sometimes unofficially referred to as the lawn boy starter. Or C, a thumb-sized flexible metal rod connected the engine at the front of the vehicle to the transmission axle located at the rear of the vehicle. It helped reduce the vibration generated by the four-cylinder engine. So that's rope drive. Rope drive is one of those three things. We'll answer both of those at the end of the show. Let's turn our attention towards our guest, Spencer. Spencer, how long have you been doing the EMS thing?
I've been working on an ambulance for about 9 years now. In various countries and in various areas of the U.S. as well. So about 9 years total.
9 years. That seems like a long time to live in the EMS world. Are you? Is the length of stay a little bit shorter than that?
Yeah, actually, usually we have an extremely high burnout rate. I even myself took like a year off myself where I went and just kind of like I did IT work for hospitals and had that like realization that like, oh my gosh, I'm so not meant to sit in an office. So yeah. Then I came back myself. And I liked the office dynamic, but just being able to be free on the open road where, you know, I'm sure you hear this from truckers as well, that your office is your vehicle. You know, we basically, that is our house. And on top of that, we work the 24 hours on, 48 hours off. So we're in this truck for up to 24 hours, a third of our life. So it really becomes our second home.
Yeah, that's the truth. So to get the credentials correctly, I've referred to it as EMS, the Emergency Medical System. What are your credentials?
I'm a firefighter AEMT. So I am what we have to have a paramedic and an AEMT on every ambulance. And that's just kind of required. I'm more of a long-term AEMT, which is very rare. And that was, I just didn't want to go through and get a dollar raise for a paramedic. So they assigned me a lot of the newer paramedics who were fresh out of school. And, you know, I kind of like, all right, let's come on, you know,
yeah.
Which is really nice because, you know, I've got a lot of that paramedic knowledge, but I haven't gotten that official certification for the extra like $20,000. So
yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm sure the gang has other questions for you, but I'm going to start us off here, which is, why did you choose this? What about this job is fulfilling to you?
So in, I think, 2012, I want to say, or 2011, there was a big tornado that came through my hometown of Chattanooga, Tennessee. Y'all probably remember it was the Great April outbreak of tornadoes. There were like over 300 tornadoes all across the southeast of the United States. And my hometown got hit by an F5. It was the same tornado that actually hit Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
My hometown.
A little more. Yeah, so you probably remember that one, I'm sure.
Yeah, I didn't live there at the time, but yeah, I heard all about it.
Definitely. So it came through Chattanooga, Tennessee, and Ringgold, Georgia, and then bounced down to Tuscaloosa. And it was a very devastating tornado. And I remember that I was one of the first ones on scene because it was hit my neighborhood. And I remember I feeling so helpless and lost, and I had no training. I hadn't even had first aid at the time. I was just lost. I didn't know what to do. And so I swore to myself that I never wanted to be in a situation like that and be unprepared. And so I kind of went down the firefighter route for a while and did the rescue thing. And that's actually where I met one of me and Mickey's colleagues, Dr. Laura, doing disaster stuff. And so, yeah, I just fell in love with it. I just wanted more and more training and kind of the more... You can go the fire department route, which is more tradition-based. It's more, you know, put the wet stuff on the red stuff. And then you have the EMS side, which is always kind of evolving. It's a newer field that a lot of people don't realize since it was only been around since about 1985. So because of that, it's a newer field. There's a lot more advancements. We're still innovating every day, and that's why I jumped into that.
Cool. So how long have you been behind the wheel of a truck?
Pretty much the whole 9 years. You pretty much, we've always been shorthanded, and this pandemic has done nothing but make that even more so.
Yeah.
But yeah, pretty much just straight out the door. The first thing you do is drive, you know, and then you kind of learn with your partner, and then you kind of, we switch off. You know, used to you had a driver that was dedicated and a medic that was dedicated, but nowadays we're both trained, and so we switch off calls because we have so many calls these days.
Yep. I'm going to surrender the floor for a minute. I do have a bunch of questions to ask you about what it means to drive and some of the cultural things around driving as well. You know, never mind that people who don't get out of the way or people who choose to follow an ambulance when it's not really their ambulance. But anyway, we'll come back to that. You guys got any questions for Spencer?
Let's go to the cynical side first. What's the hardest part about the job or the thing that frustrates you the most?
The BS calls. We have... And this is universally, I've got friends that are in Australia, I've got friends in the UK, I've got friends here in the US, and we all kind of experience the same thing, which is system abuse. People will call a 911 ambulance for the weirdest, craziest of things, and just like that does not need an ambulance. And it's really hard because you could have, you know, I think in my old county, we had 7 ambulances total, and, you know, 4 of them would be tied up on calls that don't actually need an emergency medical response. And while that's tied up, you have a shooting come in, and then, you know, that person has to wait, you know, 45 minutes, an hour to get any sort of help at all. And it's really frustrating to have to deal with that.
And do you think that's because our medical system doesn't have good triage for accessing lower medical needs? Like when I say like a kid is having a problem maybe with their asthma. And so the parents call 911 because they can't get into an an emergency medical facility.
Well, it's that. And a lot of it is just not only education of the public, but also the system itself. You will hear your doctor say 1,000 times, you know, if you have any problems, just call 911. And that is just like what's expected because they don't want to be inconvenienced a lot of times. We don't have the infrastructure that we should to properly treat people long term. Even the ER.
24/7.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and to Spencer's point, I think it also goes back to the level of what doctor care really means. You know, we used to have doctors who made house calls and they were available all the time. But like he said, now they just want to finish their cases and hit the golf course. And so we have this cultural expectation of if something goes wrong, the relief to my problem should be a phone call away, as opposed, and people don't think of urgent care or some other alternative to, you know, going straight to the ambulance or going straight to a hospital for care. But, and the only reason I'm saying this in Spencer's defense sort of is that we work together on an outfit called Usagi Medical Group. We do medical and first aid and other related things for geeky conventions across the Southeast. So we just finished Anime Week in Atlanta, had a really good time doing that. And so we've discussed some of these, you know, cultural phenomenon over the years that I've known Spencer. But anyway, go ahead, Dawn, I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, no. I mean, this is great conversation because it kind of deals to our whole culture. And on the counterpoint, to defend some of my very close medical friends, you know, they're kind of stretched thin too. You know, I wish, I know my doctors don't play golf. they're, you know, I have one friend who's just, he is so overloaded. And so when he gets a break with his family, he wants a break. He doesn't want to be, you know, answering patient calls 24/7. There's just so many things, but my next question for you was, are you trained in the community intensive care for mental health issues? Because I bet you that's area where you get a lot of calls for people of, you know, across the mental health from autism spectrum to psychosis that you know, they don't know, they're worried that the person is a danger to themselves or to others. So are you guys trained in a sort of, you know, treatment or triage around mental health or mental health first aid?
It is. Once again, this kind of goes back to this, actually some of the same points of our system being so terribly broken. We are the first line defense in my county. Now, if you go up to the county over, they call the police. The police shows up for every mental health, which is sometimes the worst situation because they are trained to escalate one level above while we are trained to escalate one level below or to de-escalate. So basically you have the two responses, obviously, of how that situation can go. You know, we're going to try to talk them down. We're going to try to reassure them. We're going to try to be there. But even our training is literally just mental health first aid. It is pathetic. You have to learn basically everything on your own in the field. And that is so heartbreaking because one of my last zones I worked in actually had a bridge that was known for suicidal issues. It was a very large bridge in the Nashville area that had consistent jumpers. And so there's actually like phone booths on each side that has a 24-hour crisis line connected to it.
No kidding.
And it's so sad that you know, it's just not taken seriously. It's similar to the military. We have a lot of people that come from the military over to EMS, fire, police, and you see that same kind of attitude of just kind of like, don't talk about it. And I think it's why we have such a high mental health issue rate in our field. Because not only are we trying to treat their mental health issues, but we haven't treated our own.
Yeah, and I'm going to just give a plug for the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. It's 1-800-273-8255. It's 1-800-273-8255. And you're right. If people would call that hotline first, I think that's brilliant that they have phone booths on either side. I mean, that's incredible. Thank you for sharing that. I know this is a tough job. So
yeah.
What fun questions can we ask?
Well, I mean, but hang on. Before we go to the fun, I have one more serious thing just before, because we're miles away now from, you know, driving in trucks and stuff like that. But this is good. This is good stuff. We're talking about the mental health repercussions and the amount of burnout in the actual field of EMS providers. Clearly we're talking about things like not only good old fashioned burnout, but PTSD and addiction and stuff like that. People who try to self-medicate to deal with their problems. So what does a driver do? What does an ambulance person do to contend with this? Do you have to simply find your own help? Do you go out and grab a bunch of magic mushrooms and eat them? What happens?
So that is actually something that they're slowly starting to work on. There's a lot of assistance right now pushing for veterans, and they're realizing that a lot of the first responder community is having a lot of the similar issues as far as PTSD, depression, anxiety, all of the above. And right now, there's no good resources. It's very county by county. It's service by service. Some places have like a really good lifeline system, but other places you will get punished for trying to get any sort of help.
Stigma is still such a big issue.
Wait a minute, Spencer. You'll get punished for trying to get help?
Yeah, and it's technically HIPAA violations for a lot of them, but it's such a small thing that it's hard to accurately report it. For instance, like in my state, I think there's a total of like 4 people total that work in the EMS office for the state. And they're over every ambulance service and every EMT and paramedic in the entire state. And so they're already overwhelmed. To get your license after you pass the test, it takes like 3 months just because they're so backlogged. So to report issues is a whole nother issue of that they're having to deal with on top of that. A lot of times we'll have people that will go and like, they'll go to the supervisor and be like, hey, I need counseling, and you'll get like 2 free sessions, which is better than nothing. But then you'll have that same coworker go and talk to another supervisor, and be like, well, you know, Spencer had to go get some help for some mental health stuff. I don't know if we can like, you know, keep him on the truck, or, you know, maybe we have to, you know, give him a break or give him some like light duty. It's not supposed to happen, but it does. And there's no safeguards really in place to prevent that, which is sad.
It is sad. And, you know, like you say, it's an awareness of a system that needs fixing. I hope we can address it.
I will give you one other resource that we are building: an online training course for substance use disorder prevention and counselors. So it's a free online course that I'm working with an international partner so that we can do evidence-based best practices across the globe on substance use disorder counseling. And so that's awesome. That's going to be great because people can take minimum suicide prevention planning. They can take and understand all the different cognitive issues, and they can understand naloxone. So I can text you that little resource. It's fabulous. I'm pretty proud of the work that we're doing. It's pretty amazing.
Dawn, is that something we can share in the show notes?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. We're halfway into getting 8 of the basic courses done. We are, by the middle of next year, we will have all 8 courses online, but some really critical ones have already gone up.
Fantastic. Cool. Absolutely fantastic.
I kind of hate to continue this really serious tone, but I know that in the Netherlands, which is where I'm currently based, despite being the only native Georgian,
amongst this panel.
It's kind of funny. Every year, especially around the holidays, our news comes out with this big, huge campaign, talking about the violence that our public servants, which includes police officers, firefighters, and ambulance drivers face. And to me, that still is astounding. It's like, you know, someone's coming to help you, or there's a medical emergency. Why would you throw rocks at ambulance drivers? Is that something that you frequently have to deal with as well?
Yes. And that's, once again, that's very community by community. So if you're in a big metro area, you're going to deal with that a lot more, obviously. But yes, we get assaulted constantly. And it's sometimes, and a lot of times, it's not something that you can just like report and send them to jail. I mean, you could, but it's not going to help, because the reason they've either assaulted you is most likely because they're sick, or like they are altered mental status. Like they don't realize what they're doing. You know, I've got a 90-year-old lady who is just like decided to attack me like crazy. And you'd be surprised how feisty a little 9-year old lady can be.
Oh, I'm not like, surprised at all, because my father-in-law was in the hospital for a cardiac event, and he also had sleep deprivation psychosis.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
And he was not he's not a super small man, but he's not, you know.
Yeah.
And he took a table, like a metal-based table, and put it through a hospital window.
Yeah, you know, it's so sad, because like you're sitting there and like you're trying to help them out, and it's, you can't really reason with them because they're not in their right mind. So you know, we have different things now. They've come a long way with giving us both chemical and physical restraints. So we're able to give them, say, ketamine or Ativan or another thing to help them calm down. If we can't get them with physical restraints, because sometimes, I mean, it's me and my partner, and you know, the nearest cop may be 20 minutes on something else. So sometimes we have to do stuff like that. They've gotten better to the point where we can now give these kind of things. We have so many tools at our disposal now that it makes it a lot safer than it used to be.
Very cool. Ben, you had a non-serious question for Spencer.
Oh yeah. So if any, you know, motor geeks are still listening at this point,
so sorry.
No, not at all. But
not your fault, no, Spencer. So, Mickey could have kept us on topic.
I could have. That is true.
He tries every week, and it usually doesn't work.
Well, what we don't tell people, was I was thinking a second ago, is that Misty is a feisty 9-year-old lady. Okay, that joke's not going where I wanted it to go. Please proceed.
Right. So from a purely, you know, motor vehicle geek gearhead, you know, perspective, what is the coolest thing about an ambulance?
So there's some really neat things and some really odd things. So one of my favorite things is, like, I will always say that an ambulance is one of the like perfect like modded camper situation for you. As soon as you like actually got all that crap out of it that's been who knows where and touched by who knows what, the electrical system in most ambulances is top notch.
Oh yeah.
You know, most ambulances have at least 3 batteries in the back of the truck, plus your regular 1 or 2 batteries in the front. It's got automatic systems for theft, where you can take out the key, and if somebody touches the brake pedal, it'll automatically shut off the whole truck and lock it down. Some really interesting stuff. It's got the oxygen system that runs throughout the entire system. So you've got a pneumatic system that you can hook to whatever air you want. There's a whole cabinet where you can put in just a bottle of whatever air. And it's got those lines already built into it that are up to these crazy regulations.
So if you are going to have a zombie apocalypse,
it is a great vehicle.
The first ambulance that you can find is what you need.
Absolutely.
The $100 million RV, like, find you an ambulance.
Exactly. And some of them even have solar power on the roof. They've got the shorelines that are already plugged up, and they've got a quick release where when you turn on the engine, it ejects the shoreline automatically. It's got special exhaust systems because we're backed into a hospital. I mean, there's all sorts of crazy features that we have.
What's the solar powering?
So it actually helps charge the batteries in the back, because we usually drain power faster than we can produce a lot of times, if the engine's off. So we actually have a high idle, which I'm sure you guys are a lot more familiar with than I am. So we're required to put it in high idle almost every time we stop the vehicle. And so it helps. It just supplements that, and it makes it so that if we're like at an ER, we can actually turn the vehicle off, and it'll keep the batteries charged while we're inside.
Very cool.
I'm making more notes. I'm like, okay, I've got all of the non-electric sewing machines and other, you know, useful stuff production. So note to self: hit the cloth shops first with my ambulance. Got it.
There you go.
Yeah. Yet it, once again, we were preparing for an apocalypse on the thing about cars.
I mean, it's fair. I feel like that's kind of, you know, being in our field, we automatically are always preparing for something like that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
We're gonna be there first and probably die first, so we already know that. So,
Spencer, in my last job, I had to buy and equip a mobile health clinic, and in the process of buying and equipping it, the first thing they started with is like, okay, well, who do you want to build the frame for it? And I'm like, I have no idea. And basically, oddly enough, we wound up getting a Mercedes Sprinter because that was what everybody else was doing. When you look at ambulances that you have known and love, who makes the best one or makes the worst one? And why?
Okay, so this is one of those controversial opinion situations.
Oh, yeah.
I personally love both the Ford and Chevys, and that is going to stir some real crap up in the pots. I know I can already see some faces getting looked at me that way. And the only reason why is because their trucks are standardized. It's something they've been making them for a long time. A perfect ambulance cab and engine, I don't have to mess with. And that's the thing. Now, if you're a good mechanic and you know what you're doing, I think the Sprinters are great. I think the Mercedes ambulances are great. In the back, we all hate them because of usually height and width. We like a lot of space. But that we always joke and call them the van ambulances because they can be kind of ugly in the back and they're not always fun to work a code or something in. You know, when you get four people back there working on one patient, it gets a little cramped. So
that's funny because, you know, Sprinters actually have one of the lowest floors of any, you know, vehicle out there. But if you stick with the stock body, you do suffer on the width.
Yeah. And we have the cabinet to add in too.
I bet it's taller, but it's not as wide, which is what you really need.
And they're not fast either.
No. And I am also wider, not taller, so that's why I also prefer not have the Sprinters. So, and that is also a pretty common thing in our profession too. We're you know, EMS is, you know, earn money sleeping a lot of times. At least it used to be, but you know, we do like a good meal. So, definitely, we like the more space. All the new ambulances are actually going to a track system, so. Used to, I don't know if you're familiar with a traditional ambulance, you have the bench seat on one side of the patient, and then you have what's called the captain's chair, which is at the head of the patient, or the airway chair. Nowadays, because of there's been so many fatalities in ambulance crashes, they're realizing this isn't safe. Mm-hmm. You know, the patient is strapped in, they're good to go. If the ambulance turns upside down, they're just hanging there and they're fine. But there is no way to easily seatbelt us while in the back of the ambulance. The seatbelts are there, but no one even touches them. In fact, most of the time we use them to actually strap in equipment because, you know, a 100-pound monitor or a 100-pound, you know, oxygen tank flying is way more dangerous than me flying across the room in our eyes anyways, because then we're worried about the patient, not ourselves. So now they have two captain's chairs and they're on like a actual track system. It kind of looks like those old stair chairs when you're going up and down to like a grandma's home. They've got the little, like, you know, hover around chair that goes down the stairway. It kind of looks like that. So that's kind of what everyone's going to. And so still, those are fitting best with the Chevy and Ford models for the most part. You're having your real reliability because most of your EMTs and paramedics are not mechanics. Half of them don't know how to change a tire or the oil. In the same way that, you know, we harp about people not being able to know medical stuff. You guys would be harping on us just as much for not knowing how to change our own oil. So it's one of those education things as well. But because of that, it's one of those things, you know, you can beat up and handle, and it'll keep moving for the most part.
Oh yeah.
So go ahead, Ben, sorry.
I was going to say, and I won't blame you if the first response to this question is, huh? But, cause you might be a little too young to know what I'm talking about, but having a fire and rescue in your background, do you identify more with John Gage or Roy DeSoto?
I like John Gage because he's more goofy, but I hope my skill level is on the other side of that.
So. Great answer.
Yeah.
Ben, you want to put some context on that for the listeners?
Yes, these are the two lead characters in the TV series Emergency, which ran in the 1970s, and it was a very good representation of the kind of the birth of paramedic programs in the United States. It was made with a lot of input from state of California and county of Los Angeles. They were involved in the production and the actors wore real fireman badges in the series. A lot of people don't know that. They had to turn them in at the end of every day shooting and they issued them in the morning. And it was lots of fun. It was so in depth that the producer of the show wound up serving on the LA County board for emergency services just because he'd learned so much. But
the treatments are extremely accurate too, which is why I think all of us love that show, is because it's not Chicago Fire where they're doing who knows what.
Right.
Like, it's actually what we would do. So,
and, you know, a lot of people have forgotten it today, but, you know, I watched it as a kid. It was one of my mom's favorite shows, and I still watch it. If I'm ever home during the day, one of my over-the-air channels shows it every single day, and I tune in because I've seen them all like three times or more, but I love it. It's a great show.
I love it when we have one of these journeys into Ben's secret passions.
Right. I also love seeing all the old cool cars they crash on these shows, you know, between Emergency and Chips and Adam 12 and all that. I see all these cool cars get busted up, you know.
There goes Don.
There's Don's going to start crying.
Yeah. And then you have the UK series, which I haven't watched, and I really need to watch that, called Bloods, which is like a comedy. It's like it 100% centers around EMTs in an ambulance, and you have like this really stoic guy who is partnered with this super ultra chatty divorcee. And I haven't watched it yet, but that's on my list. But some of the previews I've seen for it is like absolutely hysterical.
How long does an ambulance stay in circulation? Like, what's the lifespan of an ambulance?
That is,
you know,
highly debated, depending on the service. So at the service I'm at, I'm very, very lucky. We usually don't have, at the moment, we usually do by miles. I mean, it's just kind of the easiest way for us to do it. I'm sure it's kind of the standard anyways. So for us, we try not to go over 200,000 miles. After that, we usually sell it in another company who can't afford as good of an ambulance. We'll take it, and then our county will buy us a new one. We currently have, I think, 140 employees, and we're at right at 18 ambulances. And most of them are within our, I think our oldest one right now is 3 years old. So,
Spencer, I have a couple questions. You know, how much does a new ambulance cost?
It hurts. It's anywhere from upwards of $1 million to around $200,000 to $250,000. It is a astronomical price, and fire engines are even more expensive.
So
I know our newest station, just the building alone was like $6.3 million, just to house two people and an ambulance. It's nuts, the equipment that's now required. So
that's crazy.
I can tell you that when we chose our house, we chose it strategically to be a mile from either fire and rescue station.
And
like, we are in the middle. We are a mile from one and a mile from the other, and so they could come from either side.
What are you saying, Spencer?
Yeah.
Oh, I was just saying that, and it helps your insurance as well. That's actually a really good thing, because apparently it helps your homeowner's insurance as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a house where they, after the fact, they actually put in the fire hydrant system about a couple years after we moved in. And my father was surprised to find out that having a fire hydrant in your yard, like, really reduced your homeowner's insurance. So
it's true.
He was very happy.
It's actually really funny. There's an entire system that is kind of how I was started in the fire service, where we didn't have hydrants, and because it was a more rural area. And when you do that, you have to do these entire tanker squadrons. It's called the water shuttle, and you literally go in and you have this tanker task force that comes in, and they do these like cycles to the nearest hydrant, of bringing like thousands and thousands of gallons of water. And I mean, 5,000 gallons of water on a good house fire, you're talking 5 minutes, 10 minutes, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's crazy. When we were talking about this at Anime Week in Atlanta, Spencer, you mentioned that you had to have a special certificate to be able to work on an ambulance. I mean, like,
yes,
like get under the hood.
Yeah, they want you to have what's called, I think it's emergency vehicle technician. Let me proofread myself on that. I'm pretty sure it's EVT. Yeah, it's EVT certification. That's it. And so that is what they are required to have to work on a emergency vehicle. Now, however, of course, it doesn't always work that way, but a lot of the dealerships can technically be sued if they don't have an EVT on site and they're working on ambulances.
That is amazing, because on the one hand, it's just a vehicle, right? It's just a very specialized vehicle with a few extra parts. On the other hand, those extra parts are actually pretty sensitive. They have to adhere to certain tolerances. They have to not short out when you need them.
So does the EVT work on the mechanics of the vehicle, and then someone else works on all the medical equipment?
So,
or is it the
same? Yeah, so they are not allowed to touch any of the actual medical equipment. An EVT can only work on the box itself, and the mechanical parts of the engine, the actual vehicle itself. Because like most weird vehicles like this, you know, it's basically just a truck front with the box dropped on the back, which is a whole nother issue. And I'm sure you guys could have a lot more opinions about that and the crazy welding problems that people do whenever they try to put these things together. But that's probably why they needed the special certification, because they make some really Frankenstein ambulances, and we get in the back and it looks like, you know, there's a poltergeist in the back with all the lights flickering and crazy things happening.
I heard years ago that I don't know what company it was, but one maker of ambulances supposedly employed a whole bunch of Hell's Angels to do the electrical work in them. And supposedly they did really, really excellent work. But this would have been years ago. I don't know where or what company, but I was kind of amused by that.
The Hell's Angels ambulance. That's hilarious.
While we're talking, about this, I'm scrolling through used ambulances for sale, because I really think we're going to need a thing about cars ambulance.
I'm right there with you, man. I'm like, let's make this happen. Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite places that I've had the best success buying from was Brindley Mountain. I think it's just firetruckmall.com, I think is what the site is. And a lot of guys just get on there and look. Yeah, it's just a hilarious name, but they actually have a really good service, and they've always done really good to all the companies I've worked for. Chris, and you can get way cheaper fire trucks and ambulances from them.
We're going to need some major sponsorship to put gas in that thing, though.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
But on the other hand, the ambulance is, you know, it's big enough that we could prominently put sponsorship logos on there. So,
that's true. That's exactly right.
They would definitely, you know, get bang for their buck. I mean, we could say, you know, like X number of dollars for per square inch of.
You can buy a square inch. Yeah.
I actually did that for, there's an emergency management agency, which is, they do like everything that fire, police, and medical doesn't do, like rescues and stuff like that. And we actually did that with a group we had. I think it was twice daily that ended up bringing on. And so it looks so ridiculous, but you know, they paid for it. So they paid like $200,000 to put like twice daily on the side of this big box truck. And it's like, what on earth? It just looks silly going down the road with all these lights on. Like, they responding to give emergency coffee? Like, what are they doing with that thing?
Emergency coffee. That's great.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
All right. So I've got a couple of passages here that I picked up off of Reddit some time ago about emergency services stuff, or things that are sort of related to these things. I'm going to read these and let's see if you have any reactions to them. And this is for everybody. This is not just Spencer. So this person is named McFeely Smackup. And McFeely Smackup says, back in the time before GPS was commonly available everywhere, I was a police officer working on a late shift. A call came in that a woman was having a heart attack. Ambulance was en route to an address something like 1234 Cherry Street. So I pulled out my old-fashioned paper map of my patrol area and headed to Cherry Street. When I got to Cherry Street, the ambulance was parked with lights going, so I got out and asked why they were just sitting there. They said they couldn't find the address. I checked a few houses and the number were all 5 digits, not 4. So I got in my car and drove really fast in the directions that the numbers were going down. Then crossed a major intersection, and then they started going up again. I confirmed the address with dispatch twice, asked someone to find where the address was located, and they eventually figured out it was Cherry Loop, not Cherry Street, and was therefore in a completely different part of town. So a different ambulance and patrol was dispatched. The woman died, and there's no way to be certain if faster EMS response could have saved her, but to this day, every time I see streets with the same name, but road/court/way/loop, et cetera, Peachtree. North, south. Right, Peachtree. It makes me. It makes me unreasonably angry, McFeely Smackup says. We're not going to run out of words or numbers to use name nowadays, so why are we duplicating them? I'm sure that there's some frustrations about that here. Spencer's nodding the entire time. So,
yes, that is surprisingly common. Even now, when we now have an entire CAD system or a computer automated dispatch system in the truck. So we get the direct feed as the dispatchers are typing the words in. We can see that in our system. And even then, we still get addresses wrong. In Nashville, we have a road called Old Hickory Boulevard, and it circles through, I think, 4 counties, and it's one single road called Old Hickory Boulevard. It has like 23 zip codes, I think, in one road, which is nuts. It's something stupid like that. And depending on which part of 65 you're on, depends on if you're on the south side of Nashville or on the north side of Nashville. And that's a huge difference. In fact, it's three counties in between each side. So it's really shocking that we actually have someone that does nothing but mapping. It's the 911 address office. And their entire job is to make sure that Google Maps, Apple Maps, all of your apps, as well as all of our system software and like mapping software is up to date.
Yeah.
We used to obviously just use the map book. In fact, whenever we used to get a call, you had to tell them, all right, responding to blank address in map grid blank. And so you had to tell dispatch to hopefully avoid that, mm-hmm. you know, hey, this is where we're heading. This is the map grid.
Right. Yeah. And we live we live in a town with what, 70 something peach trees.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So this one, my last one here is from a reader named Spiral MX. And Spiral MX says, the one and only time I ever had to call 911 was interesting. It was around 1997 and I lived in a suburb of Atlanta. I was getting on I-85 northbound and looked over and saw a car on fire on the southbound side of 85. I grabbed my cell phone and called 911. Now, I had purchased the phone in Fayetteville, where I lived. The car fire was happening in Union City, about 15 minutes away. The call went something like this. The operator says, 911, what's your emergency? I said, yeah, I'm getting on I-85 North at Union City, gave her the exit number, and there's this car on fire on the southbound ramp. The operator says, sir, you've called Fayetteville 911. You need to call Union City 911. And the caller, Spiral MX, says, well, how the heck do I dial a different 911?
I had a similar experience one time in Texas. I was out on a motorcycle ride in the kind of rural country south of Fort Worth. And it was a group ride. And the guy in front of me crashed. I was the last person in the group, but he was the second to last. So I was the only person who saw it. So, you know, I called 911. They told me the same thing, that I was speaking with the wrong jurisdiction. And they could offer me the phone number for the right jurisdiction, but the only way I could take that number down was find a stick and write it in the sand, which was kind of soft and didn't write it. So I didn't get very good numbers in the sand. And I think I did eventually get the right jurisdiction, but boy, what a blankety blank situation that was.
Yeah, it's a mess. And luckily where I'm at, we have a pretty good system to where they could just literally transfer you.
Yeah.
One of the most common ones is if you're on the interstate, technically you're supposed to, I think, dial THP or the highway patrol. But like, even I don't know that number off the top of my head, you know, because if you call 911, you're now supposed to be routed to the closest cell tower. And that's the jurisdiction you're going to get. If they should know enough to go, all right, he's at this mile marker. This is the ambulance that goes, and be able to just relay that information electronically.
Yeah, yeah, but I'm sure with cell numbers, I mean, you could be sitting in your house and be bounced off a cell tower that's just not even close to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, you know, because of geography being what it is and service ranges being what they are, I don't think it's ever going to be foolproof, but it should at least be slightly more seamless. I don't know. I don't know if I'm fair in saying that or not. But
no, I agree 100%. I think that, you know, it's still a kind of thing that, you know, EMS is new, but fire and police is not. Fire and police has been around for a very long time, and dispatch has been around for a pretty good amount of time as well. And we're getting more advanced with some of the new technology stuff that we've starting to implement, but it still has a lot of work to go. We've still got a long way.
Is the history of EMT out of Vietnam or?
Not that I'm aware of. It actually used to be the hospitals based. So like Ben was talking about with the show, in the 70s, they did pretty much pilot programs where the hospitals had ambulance based. They were based out of the hospital. So basically you would respond from the hospital and that was how it worked. Nowadays, you know, it's fire based or it's hospital based, but you have your own stations and everything. But a lot of times it was you either get an ambulance for a coroner or you get an ambulance for just a transport with no medical professionals on board. So
I'm curious.
Awesome.
And I think a lot of older folks wonder, I mean, when you're having a heart attack, call 911. But what about a stroke? Right. Should
absolutely.
You know, I worked for the American Heart Association for a blip of my career, and we said call 911 for heart or for stroke, but you end up having a lot of people just take their spouse or their family member themselves. What tell us what can be done if one is having a stroke. Why would it be better to call the 911 than put someone in a car?
So the biggest thing, and I will say this, you know, we joke about, you know, the BS calls that we get. I'm talking about like a toe pain. I'm talking about like, you know, my knee has been hurting for 3 months, which was literally the call I had last night. It's very common. Now, if you have chest pain, if you have any sort of like headaches with dizziness, if you're having nausea, vomiting, anything that could be serious, absolutely call us, because not only am I going to get on scene faster, I can diagnose quicker. We are now basically a mobile ER in a lot of aspects. Oh. We have everything we could do in the ER minus like CTs and x-rays. There's a lot of things. Our ambulance, in fact, even has blood products now. We have whole blood on the ambulance. So if you get on scene and you're having stroke symptoms, not only can I start a drug that basically can break up that clot or at least keep it from clotting more, I can also alert the hospital that we're coming so that when we get in the door, we don't even stop in the ER. We go straight to the CT. They know it's called stroke alert. They know we're coming and we go straight in, and they actually time it. It's a whole thing that they say you're not allowed to be on scene for more than like 3 to 5 minutes max. And in the first like 3 minutes, you need to have them on the monitor. I mean, we're already got them. We've got a full picture of their heart with what it's called a 15 lead. We're actually looking at the conductivity through the heart to see exactly what's going on, what muscles are contracting, all sorts of crazy stuff that we can do with both heart attacks and strokes. So never feel bad about calling for a heart attack, a stroke, anything serious. We want you to call. And even if it's a false alarm, we're not going to be mad at you ever for calling us.
Thank you.
So don't call you if I'm out of vodka. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. Yes. I was just thinking about my night last night where I have
another
24 hours. So
weird, strange question. And, there are these companies that are usually in a Sprinter van that go around to people and give them fluids.
Yes.
What the heck is going on with that? And the only reason I know about that is because I'm in the world of substance use disorders. What?
It is. So I think it's a terrible idea. Because personally, this is once again my personal opinions on this, but these people are not doing proper labs. They're not doing what they need to do to make sure they're not going to throw you in a fluid overload. They're not doing what they need to do to make sure they're not going to mess up your pH levels. They're just dumping fluid. Even when we give fluid, you have to go to the hospital as soon as you get fluid so that they can check your lab values. These people are just going in. We've had multiple situations that I've heard around the country where like they'll have an infiltrated IV, which is where it goes like into the muscle and not in the actual arm. And they're causing all these terrible things to happen. And people just like, they're just getting away with it, which is just, they'll shut down that company and change their name and open up another one in another city.
What the heck? And
it just blows my mind that they're able to do this.
But is this also not maybe a byproduct of...
It's crappy regulation.
You know, because I know, like I said, it's that, but it's also, you know, a broken healthcare system, you know, and I say this as someone who's lived in the Netherlands for 17 years, and like 3-4 years ago, I fell in the middle of Amsterdam and broke my arm. For the record, it was 9 a.m. I was on my way to work. I was sober. Just saying.
That's fair. That's a good thing to say. Is that, you know, just, you know, but I mean, we understand.
I broke my arm. It was like, you know, it was like right almost at the shoulder joint. And, you know, that picked up my phone, called, you know, 112, because we're weird here. You know, we have to have different numbers. Nice little ambulance people came by, you know, and, you know, at the end of the day, I got a bill for 400 euros because my deductible was 385 and I hadn't met that yet. And that's literally all I got.
That's actually extremely cheap, especially compared to US systems. Which is sad.
A lot of times US systems will deny your ambulance trip.
Yeah, actually every ambulance in the United States is out of network. Every single one. They are not in network. It is for whatever reason. insurance has decided that it is all out of network. And so you're going to get a bill of between $800 to $1,500 just for the ride alone. Just if I don't do a single thing, it is that much money. And it is a terribly broken
system. And
that's
the other problem is why we have people that don't call and stick their loved ones in a car when they're having a stroke or a heart attack because they don't want to pay the $1,500 deduct or the $1,500 fee.
And this is a topic for a completely different podcast. I think this is something we should definitely talk about, but we are way over time for this episode.
It's good.
No, absolutely. It is going to end up happening, but it's right. Oh God, the whole insurance thing. Now I am going to get mad, but
between me and Don, you know, we could probably put together a really pleasant rant and, you know, I have so much frustration, especially with candidates from where I'm originally from, because I still vote in lots of elections. I have two passports. Every politician needs to be afraid of me. you know, my biggest frustration during election season is, you know, I'm like, you know, everybody's like, oh, single payer. And I'm like, I don't like that. Here's the Dutch system, which is privatized and regulated. And you know, it's a really good system, you know, and it's really people focused. And I've yet to have a candidate that will actually sit down and talk with me and read the literature that I have, you know, and Spencer, I just want to say, you know, I have an aunt who, you know, was an ambulance driver up until she passed away from complications many years ago. And before that, she was a nurse. And the medical profession is, you know, is right up there with teachers. You know, your stress level is so high. The lack of appreciation is so widespread. And, you know, you guys are heroes. And the crap you have to go through, you know, just to do your job, you know, it's not a job for glory. It's not a job for, you know, getting rich. You do it because you love it. And I can see that about you. And, you know, I just want to say thanks, you know, and the next time I'm stateside, I'll buy you a beer. And if you ever come to Amsterdam, look me up and I'll show you where all of the pornographic licorice is.
Sorry, did you say pornographic licorice?
Dave is doing a face palm, epic face palm.
I can't believe I'm the one who's about to say this, but Mickey, why don't you get us back on topic?
All this being nice, Dave, it doesn't happen very often.
Oh, I think it's going to happen right up to the even point where we started down the path of pornographic licorice, and I'm like, I don't even want to think of where the show's going to go.
I was going to say, Missy, you could have just bought him a beer over there.
We're not only not off the rails, we're in the next county.
This is gone. Now, Spencer, what's your dream car?
Mine personally is a 1969 the Shelby Mustang. That's my current one. My friend actually has it, and I stare at it entirely too much every time he sees it, and he actually lets me rent it for like $100 because he's such a good friend. I still have to pay him for it. So I do it so that he could, I think it has to do with insurance. He has to like technically rent it because he runs a car business for the film industry.
Yeah.
But that's my dream.
That is a very cool dream. Question number two, where is your next road trip going to be?
That is a great question. I feel like I do more road trips to Atlanta to see you guys more than anything here recently.
Which makes us very happy, I got to tell you.
I have always wanted to take like an off-road, like a good off-landing vehicle and just go out west. Most likely I'm thinking Colorado or Arizona, just to like escape. Yeah. I think that would be so cool to just kind of like get away from all the city, all the hustle and bustle, and just get away.
I don't know how you feel about Utah, but Utah's got some good country for that too.
Good to know as well.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Question number three, what is the most fascinating thing you've ever seen on the road or in someone's garage?
As far as, I don't think I could tell you the most fascinating things because it's probably a little past PG because of my profession, but
well, we've already crossed that line, I think.
You're up against pornographic licorice, Spencer. You're gonna have to work.
I mean, fair. All right, I'll go for it. We actually had a wreck into a garage, and it had hazmat placards on it, and we were super confused why, because it was a pickup truck. And it turns out that the pickup truck that it wrecked into in the garage was full of like 50 gallons of bull sperm, and it was nitrogen placards to keep it cool. And so we go in and we like all looking and we realize what this is. And luckily we had a rookie who we just like handed a shovel and we're like, good luck, buddy. And we just like sent him in to go deal with the like 50 gallons of bull sperm that has now covered this entire garage.
Oh, that's funny.
There are so many
good rookie
things Dave wants to say.
You can see it on his face. He's like, I can't.
So
I can't
many
do it.
Things he can say right now.
So many things are.
Don't do it, Dave. Don't.
So many things are trying to leave my head. There's a traffic jam just behind my nose.
This is why I love the rural South. This is why I love the South. You know, it's absolutely. You know, and whereas I'm just like, yeah, that sounds about right. You
know? Yeah, it's like for us, like, oh man, that's a lot of money. You know,
like, yeah, I'm like, ooh, that's a lot of money. Yikes.
For another show, there is a tale of my life at Delta Airlines where we misrouted 50 gallons of horse sperm, but not for
sure. I mean, fair. I mean, fair. Like I can say, I never thought that
I'm
was a
just
thing.
Like getting that much. Like, oh,
50 gallons. Jeez.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And it was like grade A bull sperm. So I guess
oh,
it was
some
worth
happy
a lot.
Cows.
And I actually have a story about collecting pig sperm.
That is okay. That is the world's worst intern job.
Yeah. We're not going to do the thing about sperm, and we're not going to do the thing about animal husbandry either. So just forget it.
This is what happens when you bring on someone from the medical field into your podcast. We just derail everything.
Oh. All right, Spencer, last question for you. Those are our three standardized questions for all of our guests. And I do want to echo what Misty said before we go on to our last question. I'm really glad you got to join us today. It's been a great pleasure knowing you over the last several years. My last question for you is, what is your favorite food?
Oh, my favorite food? Oh, man, I'm fat. That's not fair. well, let me think about that.
Barbecue, potato chips, and dill pickles.
No, don't feed him an answer.
This is going to be really hilariously fat. One of my friends runs a sandwich podcast, actually. And he recently made me a gnocchi sandwich, like calzone situation with like a marinara inside. And so a gnocchi sandwich is now my absolute favorite thing in the world.
I need to talk to your friend.
Yeah. Yeah. It should be illegal.
Okay, I would do a take on that. I would do a gnocchi truffle sandwich with Alfredo sauce.
Oh, okay.
Y'all are really making me miss the fact that the Subway here in the Netherlands doesn't do the meatball sub.
Oh, I love that meatball sub.
What are you guys doing for dinner tonight? Anyway, let's Spencer.
It's 7 o'clock.
It's always good to see you, and I hope we get to see you here in Atlanta again soon. But to further echo what Misty said, it's just amazing to me that people don't realize the actual size of the infrastructure behind you guys. That's strictly dedicated to a life-saving measure, and that the work that you do is also just huge and impressive. And I'm just, you know, proud to call you my friend as amongst those who do that kind of work. So thank you for joining us today. I hope you'll come back to the microphone at some point, and we won't have to talk about bull sperm if you don't want to.
All right. As long as you don't bring the pornographic licorice, I'll be all right.
Pornographic licorice. You got it.
I'm there. I'll just have to get it through customs again without and dying.
I believe we have the title of this episode.
Yeah. You get a lot of those from me.
Anyway, all right. So two questions from Trivia Czar Tim. We're going to do these in reverse order here. Trivia Czar Tim asks, what is GM's rope drive introduced on the 1961 Pontiac Tempest? Is it a thumb-sized flexible metal rod connecting the engine at the front of the vehicle to the transmission / axle located at the rear of the vehicle, which allegedly helped reduce vibrations generated by the four-cylinder engine? Or is it a smaller, lighter starter motor tightened by a spool of cable instead of a spun gear to turn over the engine? This was sometimes unofficially referred to as the lawn boy starter. And option three, was it a steering wheel made of thick cotton rope covered in rigid bake-like resin designed to collapse during a significant collision? Which of those, Dave, our guest first, Spencer, which of those do you think might be the right answer?
I'm going to go with number two because I feel like that's the most logical in my not car brain. Because I've seen a lawnmower before.
So the lawn boy starter. So got it. Know. Don, what do you think?
Oh, I'm you know, I remember a steering wheel that looked like rope. Back in the day, and I don't want to pick that one, but I'm going to for some stupid reason.
Okay, so the rope steering wheel, Misty. What do you think?
I'm going with the lawn boy drive.
Lawn boy.
Yeah.
Dave, what do you think?
It was a flexible drive shaft.
A flexible drive shaft.
Yes.
Dave's going out on his own on this one. Ben.
Yeah, I basically agree with Dave. I think that's what your first option was supposed to be. And for the record, how many of us are hearing about a Pontiac Tempest and not picturing Marissa Tomei in a courtroom?
Well, the gentlemen who picked thumb-sized flexible drive shaft are correct. It was something that connected the engine to the transmission at the back of the car. Well done, gentlemen. That's good stuff. Second question from Trivia Czar Tim. The Pontiac Fiero mid-engine sports car was sold from 1984 to 1988. What does Fiero mean? Does it mean cruel, proud, wild, fiery, or all of the above? Spencer?
Oh, my bad. Fiery, maybe?
Fiery is your choice? It seems,
I'll go with it.
Seems like it. Dave, what do you think?
Fire.
Fire. Ben?
Yeah.
Fire. Yep. Don?
Chris is yelling in the background. All of the above. All of the above. And
is that your choice?
Yeah. It is all of the above, but you know.
Uh-huh. And Misty.
Fire.
You think fire? See, I modified Tim's question a bit. I threw in the word fire, which is absolutely the wrong answer. All the other ones are correct. All the other ones are correct except fire.
But that wasn't an answer choice.
It wasn't. What? So
that's correct. It was not an answer choice.
The above because I knew it wasn't fire.
I threw a curveball in there. So Don will get this one by default. Fiero means cruel, proud, wild. Fiero can mean all of these things in Italian and or Spanish. Well done, you guys. I'm sorry about the curveball. You guys can pay me back at some point, but.
Oh, we will.
It will. Yeah, it'll be bull sperm, but we'll pay you.
Dave, can you take us out?
Thanks for listening to The Thing About Cars. We hope you've enjoyed the show. If you have not enjoyed the show, please take it out on any other podcast, possibly one about sandwiches.
And in the meantime, thank you for listening. Please rate us if you will, and join us for another episode of The Thing About Cars. We should see you in about a week. Take care, everybody.
See ya.
Hello.
See ya.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.